Welcome to Maintainable, the podcast where we explore the art and sometimes the mess of software that lasts. I'm your host, Robbie Russell. On this episode, I'm joined by Brittany Ehlich, co-host of Overcommitted Podcast, speaker, and a senior software engineer at GitHub. Much of Brittany's career has revolved around working inside complex, long-lived systems, which helps shape her strong views on evolving existing software rather than defaulting to full rewrites. She also recently spoke at GitHub Universe, where I was able to attend, where she demoed how she's been experimenting with coding agents to help burn down technical debt in a structured and repeatable way. Brittany joins us from Portland, Oregon, in the United States. Brittany Ehlich, welcome to Maintainable.
Thank you so much for having me.
So to get things started, what do you believe are a few common characteristics of, dare I say, well-maintained software?
I think that any software can be well-maintained if people put the effort into it. And most of the time, it is worth the effort. If it's something that is in production and actively being used by users, it's a good idea to try to maintain it instead of scrapping it for something new.
I'm going to press you on that a little bit. Like, what would be maybe a trait of something? Maybe there's software that deserves to be maintained, but like, what would be some, like, if you were to look at an existing code base, what are some things that you think you'd be like, oh, this seems to be well taken care of, or there's some good stewardship behind this?
I think that the number one thing that I look for is a readable code base. If it's not readable, then I can't do anything with it. If I can't understand it, then...
Do you use the metaphor technical debt very often in your day-to-day work?
I do, yeah.
Do you feel like your perception or definition of it has evolved throughout your career?
I think so. I think I used to think that technical debt was really just, you know, long-standing things that folks have wanted to change about the code base. And I previously worked on a team where I was with a product manager who drove most of our backlog and what we prioritize each sprint. And he would say, okay, you get 10% of the code base for tech debt, 10% of your time for tech debt. And we would have to fit all of our bugs and maintenance tasks and everything into this 10% of our time. Yeah, which just never really worked super well. But now I look at it as basically anything that doesn't, you know, drive towards a new feature.
Do you find it to be a useful metaphor?
I think it depends on who I'm talking to, because it can mean so many different things. I feel like I usually have to level set. This is what I mean when I'm referring to technical debt, so that somebody can keep track, because everybody has a different definition.
Now, what about if it's like, let's say a teammate, like another developer in your team, how might you then frame it under that context?
Yeah, if it's a teammate, then we're all pretty much on the same page on what belongs on our technical debt backlog versus the rest of our backlog. And we have two separate views of, these are the features and epics we're actively working towards, and this is the technical debt things that we want to see evolve in the code base, but might not actually deliver a new feature for customers.
From your perspective, what do you think people tend to misinterpret when they talk about things like technical debt or those things that are in the backlog that aren't, maybe, I feel like maybe separating bugs, or do you think that bugs fall under that category? Or is that stakeholder maybe trying to bundle too many different things and like there's bugs that just need to be fixed, or versus the things that the development team knows, like, hey, we need to take care of these things, and it's not necessarily user-facing issue, but it's something under the hood that might make our quality of life as a developer or the software more maintainable in the long run.
So I think that a bug could be considered technical debt. It really depends on what that bug is. If it's something that a user is looking at every day and that thing is very clearly wrong, then I think that that's probably easy enough to argue, hey, this is going to support a customer doing something better in our application. So that's really more customer facing and just treat it as a separate bug. Whereas if it's something that's, you know, in the back end of your code and like the way that this resolves, sometimes there's a race condition when this runs, that's a bug that might not be as evident to customers. And I think that it can be really hard to quantify a lot of those problems if there's not a direct link to, you know, this thing is going to satisfy these customers, or this thing is going to, you know, result in more money or something along those lines. Those technical debt things can be hard to quantify, but they add up over time to large, important things like, this is running smoother. I'm not getting paged at 2 a.m. to deal with this problem.
With that challenge of quantifying, have there been any scenarios or experiments where you feel like that's worked? You found like a good pattern, or your team found a way to prioritize those things? Because you could... I mean, some teams might have dozens, some might have hundreds of items in some backlog of like the wish list of tech debt, whatever your team might want to call it. Like when we have time to use that 10% example that you shared there, some teams talk about 20%. I don't know if anyone ever actually knows exactly what the percentage is that they actually do there, but I think that's an interesting, you know, like how do you think about prioritizing that type of work or trying to weigh up how much effort it might take or how to, well, maybe we should take care of this before we take care of that, or is what's most pressing because it's, what are those types of like indicators that help you and your teams decide which things to pick off the list next?
Yeah, I think that definition has changed a little bit over time. I think in the pre-AI world, we really had to say, what is the absolute most important thing and how does this relate to customers? So if there was a thing that you couldn't directly tie to a poor customer experience, it was really hard to justify the time to spend on that technical debt. I think now we have a little bit more flexibility because we can use things like coding agents to go and take care of that technical debt, where we can now make these smaller improvements over time and not wait for things to build up to this very large problem as tech debt accumulates, and hopefully, ideally, you know, make things more maintainable and easier to evolve over time.
I'm wondering if that might be the first time someone on the podcast has used the said pre-AI world. And I only say that because we haven't had, very intentional about, like, if I'm going to bring people on to talk about AI, I just want to make sure that we're not just hyping the products that their companies might be working on and stuff like that. You know, we both were at GitHub Universe and I talked to a number of companies and they're all talking about, I'm kind of in this weird, I'm not overly skeptical, but I'm hesitant to think, well, like, this is going to take care of all the, I'm air quoting for, because nobody can see me, technical debt type work and tasks. So I'm like, there still needs to be some of humans reviewing this, and it's not going to, like, it's not always glamorous work. But before we dive into coding agents and things like that, so definitely that's going to be a big part of our conversation. I think for our audience, let's get a little bit of context for the type of work that you do. So you work at GitHub, as I mentioned in the intro. So I want to give listeners a little sense of the world that you operate in today. So for those who didn't attend GitHub Universe and didn't see your talk there and might not be familiar with your role, can you give us a little sense of the type of engineering work that you are focusing on over at GitHub?
Yeah, so I specifically work on one of the billing teams at GitHub. So I'm not directly working with Copilot, but I get to use it a lot. So I feel like I've had a little bit of time to sort of dog food and find where it's actually useful in my workflow, which is why I talk about AI things a lot. I think that it should definitely be approached with a healthy dose of skepticism, because there are a lot of things that it can do pretty okay and a lot of things that it does very poorly. It's a tool like any other tool. I think that it has absolutely been overhyped in recent years. But I feel like, you know, the time is ripe for developers and, like, people, engineers that are actually the ones doing the building day to day to, like, harness it and be like, okay, that sounds nice, but this is how I actually want to build with AI tools. And this is what's actually working for me, which is sort of what it is I've been looking at. So I work on very boring software. I work in billing. It's not the most exciting thing in the world, and it's not really supposed to be exciting. You don't talk to somebody and say, like, oh man, I love the billing experience of that product. That's not like a reason.
Hey listeners, it's Robbie here. You know, it wasn't all that long ago. I'd find myself debugging a weird issue in one of our clients' Rails app. I log into one platform to track down the error, only to realize it was tied to some performance issue. And guess what? That meant hopping over into a completely different tool and trying to match things up based off of timestamps, if I was lucky. And let me tell you, my productivity didn't exactly thank me for that. Enter AppSignal, our podcast sponsor, and the tool that eliminates all that back and forth. They bring error tracking, performance monitoring, host metrics, custom metrics, uptime monitoring, and logging into one seamless platform. It's a single source of truth that helps keep your app running like a well-rehearsed symphony. Whether you're working with Ruby, Elixir, Node, Python, or tracking front-end errors in JavaScript, AppSignal has your back. They're always adding support for more languages and frameworks too. And here's the best part. AppSignal won't break the bank. Plans start at just $23 US a month. Plus, they're ISO 27001 certified and fully GDPR and HIPAA compliant, so your data is safe. Oh, and because you're a loyal Maintainable listener, you can use the promo code Maintainable at checkout for 10% off your first year. So head over to appsignal.com Tell them that your good friend Robbie from Maintainable sent you and start making your app sing. You're making sure your teammates, the boring stuff, make sure that people gets paid, like your coworkers are getting paid and the people that owe you money are hopefully paying you and that's a seamless experience. There's a lot of problems that can go on in a billing system. People's, their credit card information stops processing and you got to contact them and they're like, well, I'm just going to cancel my account now anyways. You got to keep that money rolling in. So that's it. For what it's worth, Brittany, it's important billing, boring work.
Oh, yes. It's important, but yeah, I would say that it's not like, you know, the most exciting thing. It's only going to drive people away if it's bad. It's never going to bring somebody to a product because it's good. So it's boring and you want it to be boring. Like it's good that it's boring. It should be boring. Reliably. People shouldn't be talking about it. Yeah, it should be reliable. Working at GitHub specifically, there's a lot of very fascinating scalability issues that come with billing because I work on one of the metered billing teams. So like every single action line item and every, you know, Copilot usage and everything like that all has to add up to something in our system. And we have to make sure that that is accurate and exciting from like an engineering standpoint.
Are you also dealing with like lots of different currencies, payment methods?
Not really. A lot of that is sort of abstracted away into our different payment processors.
So I know that like GitHub is massive multi-era code base at this point. So how do you orient yourself when you're navigating a system that's grown and shifted across, let's say, many years?
Yeah, we still have the original Rails code base that was there at the inception of GitHub, and we're still actively working in that every single day. So it has seen a lot of eras, definitely. I think one thing that I use the Git Blame tool in VS Code. That's usually where I work. And that can tell me really quickly when something was changed. And usually if I can see, okay, how long has it been since this was changed? If it's been a while, then I can, you know, sort of pinpoint what were the best practices around that time that were introduced and why something was, you know, created in that way. It also links to pull requests really easily. So I can go back and look. And we have like, we've been working asynchronously since the start of GitHub. So I feel like we've done a pretty good job of documenting changes in pull requests on why something was changed a specific way, which is really helpful for getting up to speed.
Has the, from your perspective, someone that's, how long have you been there now at this point as of the recording?
3.5 years.
Have you noticed that the vibe or the templates or pull requests are quite a bit different now than the things you might be looking at? I would say in pull requests in particular from like those prior eras, and you feel like they've, what has gotten better about them and what do you find interesting about maybe some of the old ones you've come across? And I realize you might not have one like side by side right now, opened up right now, but I'm just kind of curious. So like, given that, like if they've always had good pull requests and some documentation for you to go back and look through and understanding why things exist, how has that kind of evolved there?
Yeah. In the time that I've been at GitHub, the engineering has changed a little bit where there are some places that we're using other tools where previously we only used the Ruby on Rails code base. So we have a lot more React on the front end now, and that has changed within the time that I've been there. We also have some Go microservices for certain things. So like we have a billing platform built on Go, and a lot of the action stuff that I used to work on is built on Go.
What about the pull request templates or like the style of the pull requests themselves?
We use PR pull request templates pretty frequently. And I think that for the most part, most of the main things that have been in there have been the same. You know, we always link to the issue. Sometimes I think we've introduced things like make sure that there's a feature flag involved in this. And that's like a big section that has changed since I started. Can't think of anything else. We always try to tie like observability to a pull request. So like this is where you're going to look for this change in Datadog or whatever observability tool you're using to know what impact there's going to be.
Tell me more about that. Is that for someone that might come back in the future from a future Git Blame, or is that for the people looking at a, like reviewing a PR, like a peer, or both?
I think it's both, but it also is a good way to add traceability if something goes wrong. So that big code base that I was talking about, the big Ruby on Rails monolith, since there's, you know, 1,000+ engineers working on it, we ship code using something called our merge queue that we built. So we'll group together, you know, 50 PRs at a time. And so if something goes wrong while you're deploying that, you know, if anybody who's on that merge queue can then go look through and see like, okay, what is the error? Which pull request is that likely to be associated with? Can I go look at those observability tools to figure out why that's occurring, et cetera? So it's as much for anybody on the team as it is for the people that are reviewing it.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the feature flags, if that's like a pretty standard practice now? Like maybe you don't have like a specific small, can you think of like, here I did recently worked on a PR where we shipped something and here's how we benefited by implementing a feature flag for that particular thing. And this is how it kind of got rolled out.
Yeah, we try to do a lot of shipping to learn, I guess is the, you know, the GitHub-y term for it, where we want to, you know, test things in production as much as possible. And so using those feature flags is really the safe way to do that. And I've definitely come across situations where I was very glad that I had that feature flag in place and I could turn it off and make sure that only one account was, you know, experiencing that if it introduced issues.
And is that like a thing where you'll kind of roll them out for just a limited subset of users and then test that out? Do you pick which customers are supposed to see that? Like, do you ever having to account for like hyper-focus for like, okay, we have this one really large client that has thousands of users and their GitHub users or something like that? Or are you doing that more just like it's randomly picking a couple of people of it or companies?
Yeah. So we do a thing called staff ship first. So we ship everything internally and let it bake internally because we're also some of the largest users of GitHub at GitHub. And so that helps us catch a lot of issues before customers see them. And then I think that there is a preview group that people can opt into if they want to see features sooner. I don't know exactly how that works. I just know it's an option when rolling out a feature flag that you can ship to preview users. And then we'll do like percentages of a rollout or something like that.
I feel like I've talked to some companies where they have their own engineers have to go through the onboarding and payment process themselves. Is that something that GitHub does there? How do you dog food your own billing system, I guess, my question there.
Yeah, we use it a ton. We have a bunch of staff accounts that are set up in the hundreds of different permutations of GitHub Enterprise / organization / whatever product they're subscribed to. And we do have to use our own credit cards and just remember to refund yourself afterwards.
So I'm going to switch gears a little bit. So while preparing for our conversation, I came across something you said that a big part of your early career was on rebuild projects. And often on the podcast, I talk a lot about like rewrites versus refactors. So I'm kind of curious about what nudged you towards seeing more value in maintaining and evolving existing systems. Am I understanding that correctly that you did do a lot of rewrites early on?
Yeah, I think most of my early career was spent on rewrites, where I was working on a team where we were taking whatever application it was and somebody had the grand idea to rewrite this whole thing and make it, you know, much better in this new language or new framework or whatever it was that they sold the team on. And what really drove me to dislike these projects is the fact that they never ship on time. That was the biggest driver. Is people would estimate, you know, it's going to take a year or something to rebuild this. But when you're estimating a rebuild, it's really, really hard to understand the scope of that. I think that, I mean, it's hard to estimate anything. To ask any engineer how long it's going to take to get a single task done, and you're going to get wildly different answers depending on the person. And then when you're estimating an entire project, that's that at like an even grander scale because it's thousands of tasks all put together. So I think that they're just poorly estimated typically, and they end up taking longer than they expect. And during that time, that also means you're not shipping any new features at the same time. You're just doing all this rebuild to get to parity with an existing system, which is very frustrating for everybody, for the product managers, for the customers who don't get any new features, for the engineers who keep hearing, all right, we need to wrap this up so we can move on to something else.
What do you think it is that, is it just like romanticizing the blank slate? Like we're going to do it better the right way this time, and we're going to have to learn how to use this new technology this time. What do you think developers need to be thinking about and maybe asking themselves before they go down that path?
I think pretty much every developer loves the idea of a greenfield project. Me too. I mean, even though I'm on this soapbox occasionally about, you know, not taking on these big rewrites, I love a greenfield project. It's so fun to build something new. And I think a lot of the thought is that when you get to do this, you're going to rebuild it right this time. You're going to have all this time to make sure everything is perfect and well-maintained, and you end up with the same spaghetti at the end that you started with. A lot of the same problems, especially if it's the same business case often you're going to come across a lot of the same bugs that had already been patched or fixed or band-aided in the previous system. So I think it's, you know, it's just a nice idea that in practice, it just, it often doesn't end up as utopian as I think a lot of people think it will be.
I'm curious about that in the sense that when you, especially when a team decides to like, oh, we're going to rewrite this and we're going to use this other, maybe I'm going to air quote newer or modern technology that's maybe a few years newer than the thing that we're already working with, but we can set that aside, whatever modern is, because it's going to be outdated in a few years anyways, right? But do you think there's a little bit of like teams having a drive there to be like, well, professionally, individually, I need to keep up with what where the market's moving and where the industry seems to be moving so that I don't fall behind in my own skills. Meanwhile, the team has a responsibility of maintaining something for the organization, and the organization has some responsibility of professional development. And so there's these interesting overlapping motivators, I suppose, there that aren't always in sync with each other. And like, so what's your take on how that all kind of fits together? And where do you think the individual should be thinking about that in terms of within the organization and in their own professional development?
Yeah, I think that's totally valid that, you know, people really want to be able to use the latest and greatest thing to make sure that they're staying up to date with what's happening in the industry. And that can be a big driver behind suggesting these projects. I think I've used a different language and framework at every job I've had. I started in .NET and then Java, JavaScript, now Ruby on Rails and Go. And I think that the thing that I've seen across all of these is that for the most part in all of those languages, the process of building good software is the same in each one. I think I've become language agnostic enough to say, I don't think that there's any new language that's necessarily going to do it right. I think there are some that I prefer over others, but that's really just personal preference. And I think that the most important thing when you're looking at building skills for new jobs is, can you build good software? Not, can you use this tool well? And I think you can do that in basically any language.
With Brittany in just a moment. Hey, it's me, Robbie. I just want to take a moment to say thank you for making time to listen to the podcast. If you're finding these types of conversations valuable, you know what to do. Head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, what have you, write a review, give us a rating, drop a link in your team's Slack or your Discord channels or Blue Sky or your Mastodons, your X's, your Linked, and say, hey, this episode with Brittany got me thinking about X, Y, and Z. Write a review. Write a rating. If you're not sure what to write, just do something like that. 1 star. Robbie is the worst podcast host ever. I can take it. Maybe I can't. All right. Let's get back to the show with Brittany Ehrlich. Do you think the hiring market tends to, from your perspective of you talking with your peers, seems to be indicating, you have a closer pulse, I think, probably to this than I do, because I've been running a software consultancy that primarily specializes in just a few specific technologies. So trying to like think about like, what's that like for someone in the job market and wondering, well, I know enough of different technologies that I can apply, I can show myself as a really good programmer, agnostic of that. Do you find that, or have you found that your peers, that organizations are seemingly more focused on qualitative programmer, and then the technology is like a secondary thing, knowing that they can probably pick it up given that they have a history of picking up things, or we need the specialists with lots of experience with this particular technology?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it depends on what part of the hiring pipeline you're in. I think that initial hiring screen, usually folks are looking for, oh, did you get, you know, that bare minimum of 3 years with JavaScript or whatever that the job posting has? Whereas once you get past that and you're talking to an engineer or an engineering manager, usually they can say, you've got a couple years with a similar language and that's probably good enough. And I think if anything, like it's just gotten easier over time as a lot of these systems have become more robust. I feel like a lot of them are like converging on very similar ways of, it's the design patterns are the same, I guess. So, you know, like the ability to actually write in this one specific language is less important. Probably earlier in career, maybe it's a little bit more relevant, but yeah, I could see that. And the last time I was looking for a job too was in 2022, which is a very different world than we are currently in as well. So a heavy caveat.
Well, that sounds like a really good transition back into talking about coding agents and within the context of, let's say, technical debt. So now that we have some little bit of context about the type of work you're doing in GitHub, how long you've been there, and that you're not necessarily working on the Copilot team, but you have the ability to leverage it. So I'm curious about like what sort of experiments have you been able to do? And I say that with, I'm kind of asking, I know the answer to some of this because I got to attend one of your talks at GitHub Universe. So, but for our listeners, talk a little bit about how you're using and deploying coding agents as part of your day-to-day workflow.
Yeah, so another heavy caveat that the only tools that I really use day-to-day are the ones that we have at GitHub. So I'm not familiar with, you know, every single agent that's available on the market. I do use the GitHub Copilot coding agent quite a bit. And when it was released a little over a year ago, it was available internally. And I thought, oh, this is kind of neat. You know, like, I don't know exactly what I'm going to use this for, but it's kind of cool to play with, I guess. I think a lot of the demos and stuff that I saw were like, look, build this whole new thing with this. And then you'd see what was came out at the end. And it was not necessarily the most maintainable code, but I started using it pretty heavily in early January-ish, probably, and decided we were taking on a new project. And I decided, okay, what if we just consider this like one of our teammates, somebody that we can delegate these tasks out to as we're building this and just test the boundaries and see what happens. And I think the most important part was just like using it and seeing where those boundaries are, because they're definitely there. I realized like the scope of tasks I can give, usually it's something that's pretty small. Usually it's something that I already know how to do. So I'll ask it to do that thing specifically, and then I get really great results. But if it's a big, broad thing, then not so much. I had run into a couple of really interesting bugs with it, where if I gave it a task that was too large, because the way that they make changes, like they just spit out all the code all at once instead of building iteratively like an engineer would, it can be really hard to pinpoint where those bugs will be in large chunks of work, because it's not like somebody was building something sequentially and checking it as it went. It just did everything at once. So it can make it a little bit harder to debug in those scenarios, which is how I've landed on, okay, actually, this is great for really small things.
I'm curious about with that workflow, and I've tinkered with the like the web interface for this in GitHub. Like, okay, and I did this recently, and actually did it for on my Z shell just as an experiment, and a little sidebar that actually caused some problems, which we can dig into, some like ethical issues that popped up, at least concerns about ethics. Completely separate conversation, but maybe we can dig into that. But the specifically, I was thinking about it, like, well, I was making some changes for like an open source project. And I was like, okay, we'll do this out in the open. But for that type of project, it's basically a bunch of shell scripts, essentially. And so there's not like a web UI that it's going to load up and do some browser testing and stuff. So I was like kind of curious about the for those that have like listeners that haven't actually taken those steps, how much do you need to kind of set up the environment? Is there something that you can run locally if you have, like, say your Rails app and you have like a really basic Rails app and you're like, I want to add, maybe try to experiment with taking care of some technical debt issue, or maybe add a small feature with this, make a small change to this feature. How is it running the app? Is it running it out on GitHub servers and then trying to make changes? And do you need to set up all the environment there? Kind of like similar to your CI. Or is that, do you understand how it's kind of working under the hood a little bit there?
Yeah, I do actually. So there shouldn't necessarily be any setup from the get-go. You can create a task within the agent panel or just create an issue and assign it to Copilot. And that is all that it takes to work. But there are ways to make it a lot better. So the same custom instructions you might write if you're using VS Code in agent mode with GitHub Copilot, those are the instructions you can use within your repository. So that's a great place to put, like, these are the shell scripts I use. These are the things that I want to make sure are working with each one when you run it to test it, especially for something that doesn't have tests in place. If you do have tests in place, then it will run those as it works so that it makes sure that it's not breaking things. Or if you have that set up, if you have CI set up, then it's going to run that CI to make sure that things actually pass and iterate on that to get things to where they pass. So that does make it a little bit better if you have some way to like actually test the changes. And then, yeah, I think one thing that I noticed is just starting out, it it works pretty well. But as you add more custom instructions, as you review more pull requests from it and come across things that you say, okay, this is actually the way that we like to write our tests in this application. If you, instead of just commenting on every PR or including that in every single issue, if you put that in the custom instructions for the repository, then you no longer have to tell it each time to make these changes in this way. And so you end up developing this markdown file that has these custom instructions that are really good for understanding this is the way that code is written in this repository. And it's good for new people too that come to the repository typically, because it's, you know, it's a set of instructions that say this is how we write code here. So it's not too terribly different from like a contributing file.
Now, when you mentioned, you know, hitting boundaries or setting boundaries when you check in on what the work that the agent is producing, so that I'm assuming so that you're also, how do you balance that and making sure you're not spending too much of your time babysitting it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the reasons why I enjoyed doing coding agent so much is I've been working for the past few years as a tech lead as well. And so I have already been doing a lot of the work of writing an issue and assigning it to someone. And so the skill set of writing an issue and assigning it to Copilot doesn't feel too terribly different from what I've already been working on. So one of the guidelines that I've found really works well for me is, if there was somebody brand new to the team, how would I break up this task for them? And that's roughly the same guideline I would use for coding agent, because I personally don't like, you know, making a bunch of PRs that, well, the one thing with all of it is that like every PR that it creates is one that I also know that I have to spend a lot of time reviewing. And I feel like reviewing those PRs is like slightly more cognitively tasking than reviewing a PR from a teammate. So for example, like it's not just that I'm reviewing that PR, it's I'm the first human to look at it and sanity check that this is the right thing to do. Whereas if a teammate built something, then I'm assuming that they're doing that task as they're working on it. And so when I write an issue and assign it to the coding agent, I also want to make sure that it's small enough that it'll be easy to review for me, not just small enough for it to complete the work. Because I have done the thing where I'm like, oh, okay, we're going to, you know, change the way we do mocks in this entire Go repository, and it'll make a, you know, 100 file change, but I don't want to review that at all.
You know, you bring up a good point, that something I've been thinking about recently, and I was like, well, as teams are trying to adapt and figure out how to leverage these tools, but I'm like, not everybody has the experience of delegating work. And I feel like that's what the industry might be asking developers to start doing. When are we all going to spend time training everybody on getting people like some experience doing that? But it sounds like in your environment, you're like, if you think about it from like a tech lead, is like, all right, you have a group of developers already working on things. You're already doing a bit of, you're breaking down, organizing issues, tickets, whatever, organizing the work into units of work that you can pass off to people. And you're like, all right, well, how would I treat a new person to the team? Maybe we could try that with something like a Copilot agent. Farm out a couple of those tasks, review it in a similar way that you'd be doing it with your other coworkers. Are your coworkers, your other developers on your team also taking advantage of the tools, or primarily just like a team lead right now? Like, what's that look like at the moment?
Yeah, I think pretty much everybody on my team is using them pretty regularly. So I think that I can't necessarily speak for everybody else's experience, but I think that for some people, it is a little bit more of a learning curve, because they not only have to figure out how to break down that task in a way and describe it to the coding agent, but also what, you know, level of task should be given to that, and how should you break it up, and how do you write that task in a way that is easy to understand. But I think that's also probably like a good stretch for a lot of people. You know, it's tech lead is usually some progression upon engineering where you get to a point where you're not only doing tasks yourself, you're delegating those tasks out. So it's kind of a way to get to that point a little bit faster, test those muscles in, you know, you might not get as much feedback, I guess, as you would if I were to write an issue and somebody were to say, this makes no sense.
Well, maybe you can answer this around, what work do you keep for yourself then? Very drastically, you're like, okay, this is something I personally want to work on because it's interesting to me, or is it, all right, this is probably a little bit, it's going to take me too long to probably try to like break this down for a coding agent. I don't know how to. Or is maybe that the challenge? Like, is the goal for us to try to get to like 90 to 100% of the code is being done by the agents, and we're just reviewing and creating the next things that we're working on? somewhere in between that? And then what about the other developers on your team? Are they trying to get to the point where like, all right, everything's going to get delegated to another thing, and then we've got a team of delegators?
I hope not. I don't want to live in that world personally. Yeah, I think I've heard some teams that they're like, oh, like 90% of our code is written by agents. And it's like, I like writing code. That's why I do this job. I enjoy it. So I feel like I take on roughly the same amount of tasks that I did previously. I'm still working on development actively on my own, usually with, you know, some sort of a AI tool to help me if I get stuck on something. You know, I sort of equate it to like the things that I previously would have looked up on Stack Overflow. Now I look up in Copilot. And usually the things that I keep for myself are the things where like, I don't know exactly how to fix it, or I need to explore and find the solution before I can actually describe what solution I'm looking for. And I have found that there is still just as much of that work out there. Even having, you know, having agent tools available, I still have plenty of things to work on. And my prediction is that that's going to be, you know, the rest of the industry probably is. I don't know that we're ever going to get to this point where like engineers don't have to engineer anymore. But I do try to keep a couple of asynchronous agent tasks going at a time. And so I found early on that context switching was very taxing throughout the day. So I try to break up my day where I'll spend, you know, a half an hour delegating tasks and refining them and assigning them, reviewing pull requests for them, and then switch completely to the thing that I'm working on and, you know, sort of switch gears and just focus deeply on the things that I'm working on. And I feel like I still have probably roughly the same amount of deep focus time that I had previously. I'm just able to get a lot more of those smaller things done that like I already know how to change, and it's going to take me longer to set up a development environment than it would be to like make and test the change.
It's almost like you're having some one-on-one scheduled one-on-ones with your agents.
Yeah.
So what does it look like on a day-to-day basis? So you have a half hour here or there. Is there a specific time of the day that you're like, all right, this is how I start the day. I'm going to organize some things, start a couple of those. Am I assuming that, making an assumption that there's multiple agents you have starting? You're like, all right, 5, 3, 5. I'm throwing numbers out there. And then later you're going to check in with that work and see where it's at rather than constantly monitoring it?
Yeah, I think that there's like an option to constantly monitor if you really want to, but I typically just, you know, assign a thing and then let it work and come back to it later. So my workflow really looks like, you know, the first half an hour or so of the day as I'm getting into the zone or whatever. That's usually a time where I'm like, all right, I'm not going to focus on anything anyway, so I might as well just look at these asynchronous tasks and figure out what I want to assign, or, you know, review a pull request to see if it's ready to go. And then, you know, like around lunch, when I'm coming back to things, I'll spend another half an hour. And then at the end of the day, I'll probably spend another half an hour or so.
I was going to say, is it getting to a point where you, like at the end of the day, are you then queuing up things to check in on the next morning?
Yeah. So I might pick up tasks that if anything still requires some iteration, then I'll pick it up. Sometimes at the end of the day, I'll queue it to merge. It can take a little while for things to actually merge. So it depends on if I actually want to watch something throughout the evening. Sometimes the next day, I'll just queue it first thing in the morning and then sort of keep an eye on that in the background as it's rolling out.
I'm having these weird flashbacks to working with some clients quite a while ago where they were trying to set up their development model so that they had developers 24/7 working in different time zones. So like, all right, so like some people are responsible for organizing work for the team, let's say in East Asia, to work on overnight. And then in the morning, they'd come in and review the work that they did. And there'd be this kind of like constant ball. It wasn't perfect though. And there was like, wow, there's so many miscommunications and things that I'm like, and from my limited exposure to playing with some of these tools, sometimes I'm like, it's not always perfect. And you always get, you know, success out of these things. How have you said you started doing this in January. So how has that improved? Is it, do you feel like it's been a lot more on how you approach it? Or do you feel like the technology is just improving itself at a reasonable clip so that you're not having to do you have to like spin up multiple sessions with different LLMs with the same task ever? Like be like, all right, you try it and we'll see what happens.
I've done that a couple times, and I've also spun up tasks where, you know, it's just missed the mark enough times where I just close it and like, all right, I'm just going to start over fresh. So it didn't work out the way that I expected it to. And I think one of the ways that a lot of people talk about agents right now too is like having to write this very custom thing for each task. Whereas when I use the coding agent at GitHub, usually it's just the same one that I assign it to. We did just recently release custom agents, and I think that was at Universe, and there's some cool things associated with that. We found some really cool use cases for them. But for the most part, it's just the same one, really. It's just saying, like, assign it to GitHub Copilot, and it'll decide in the background, like, what is the right tool to use to accomplish the job. And I don't have to think about it as much, which I actually kind of like. Maybe, like, an unpopular opinion in the world of people who are, like, pro AI now, but I, like, don't really like figuring out which model to use, or, you know, like, I don't care. I just want it to work.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm not in the benchmarking realm of that. I'll let someone else figure that out, and then hopefully someone else can make some recommendations. I got things to work on in the meantime. You know, for our listeners who might be hesitant or maybe skeptical about experimenting with this, but let's say they have a little bit of budget or enough free credits to try something, can you think of any kind of small, low-risk experiments that they could try?
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things is to use it to increase test coverage. I feel like that's a really great place to start, especially if you are looking at making changes with agents in your code base. I feel like having a base level of test coverage is very important to make sure that nothing's going to break as you're making changes. So I think that's a really great spot to start.
Is that just as simple as increase test coverage as the command? And is that too broad of a task? Or how would you kind of like break that down for them?
Yeah. So I would typically, I'd start small and say, you know, if there's a component that does not have 100% test coverage, and we all know that it doesn't have to be 100%. There's definitely some things that don't necessarily have to be tested. But what I would write a task that would say something like, for the widget component, test all of the edge cases, or make sure that there's tests for all of the edge cases and all of the different props that I'm sending to it, and, you know, try to get as close to 100% as reasonably possible, or something along those lines. And try to, you know, one component at a time, one folder at a time, so that you don't have a whole bunch that you have to review. Targeting it, I feel like, is really helpful.
I can see that. I'm curious about, do you ever use any other data points to help influence that? Like, here's the areas of the code base that maybe it's like you have test coverage percentages as one metric, but things like, what areas of the code base do we change most often? Maybe there's something about that's an area that might need more attention or not. Or is that the riskiest area to have maybe do an experiment with?
I think that's one reason why I like the test coverage, is because there's very little risk involved. Because, you know, if you add tests, it's not like it's going to change the way that the application works. Hopefully, if you do, then, I mean, if it does, then there's other problems that you have. But one of the other really good places to start is asking it to write your repository custom instructions. That's another thing where it'll produce a markdown file. So it's not necessarily going to change your application, but it'll go through and, like, index the repository and be like, all right, these are the things that I think are going to be useful for Copilot to have context while working in this repository. And that provides a good starting point to make sure that, you know, your follow-up issues that you assign are going to be better too.
Is it safe to assume that some of the projects you're working on involve multiple repositories?
Oh yeah, for sure.
So how well are the tools working in that type of scenario where you're like, well, this relies on something else in a different repository, but we've got custom instructions here and there's another thing over here. Is that something that's just you're having to sort out kind of in your tech lead role?
Yeah, I feel like that's something. So one example is we have a, you know, a front end code base now that we can, you know, deploy separate from our Rails code base. And so sometimes that requires a little bit of coordination if there's a change in one that has to be reflected in the other. I don't know that the agent tools really make a difference in how well that's handled. I think that's really still on the engineers while you're rolling something out to know, make sure something's backwards compatible so that you can, you know, roll them out independently or something along those lines. I don't know that the tools are quite there yet at making large cross code base changes, but maybe they will be one day.
I was thinking, as do you think like decisions like let's say put a front end side of our platform in a different repository, like those types of decisions might be treated differently now, if knowing we have different technology tools available now, like, hey, maybe we could, if we kept this in a mono repo or something. I'm not saying you have to have the answer to that, but we often organize our projects in organizations based off of the organization's makeup of how they divide up and break apart work and product teams and things like that. So like, this is our area, this is your area, but then we're also then injecting some other technology now that's might be able to move a little bit across teams a little bit more as well. But I don't know the answer to that, but I'm just kind of curious if you have any strong opinions there or curiosities there.
Yeah, no, I actually, so something that I ran into over the weekend is I just started a new side project, and it was the first time that I really heavily used agent mode. I haven't done that a ton because I feel like day to day, there's, I want a little bit more control, I guess, over the things that I'm working on. But I was able to use, I had three different repositories set up, and I was like in a folder that contained those three repositories, and one was the back end, one was the front end, and one was the docs. And I was able to assign tasks that would make changes to all three repositories at once. So I think as long as you're in that sort of a view where you can see all of them at once, it's possible to make changes across multiple repositories that like all respond to each other. I don't think that the coding agent is quite there just yet. I don't really have strong opinions personally on like monorepo versus not monorepo. I don't really mind. Whatever is there is fine. I do think that it's probably easier to do a mono repo if you're primarily making changes with coding agents. But I also don't know that we're ever going to get to a place where like coding agents are doing 100% of the work. I hope not. Because like I said, I like engineering. It's fun.
Agreed. And I feel that way as well. I'm thinking about, you know, we gave our audience the experiment of maybe adding some more test coverage. And with that prompt being able to be more specific to a specific component or folder of your application, then what? What else do you think they could do? Do you think like maybe they're, what would you say to those who have teammates who are a little more skeptical of it? And they're like, hey, what are you doing? And like, but they want to like start experimenting. They feel like they should just go in and start, you know, having Copilot co-sign some of their Git commits and be like, hey, look at what I did. Or how would you encourage people to kind of think about introducing this into the team without it becoming this huge, I feel like that might be a hurdle for some teams. Like, well, we're not using it yet. And if I start doing the first one, there could be a reaction to that that I have to then also navigate, or I have to sell everybody on it before I do that first experiment.
Yeah, no, that's valid. I think I live in a little bit of an AI bubble where like everybody's pretty much gotten to the point where they're pro AI. So I haven't personally had to deal with a ton of that, but I can understand how folks might come across that and be uncomfortable. I think starting the, one of the ways that a lot of the AI stuff that I think is kind of a mistake, one of the ways that it has been rolled out and sold to a lot of people is like, look how many more features you can build and like, look at, you know, all this new stuff you can add to your code base. And I kind of feel like that's not the right way to talk to engineers about it. Cause I look at that and I'm like, oh great. Look at all that code I get to maintain now. Cool. So I think that if you're trying to sell it to your team, then starting with like a problem that already exists in your backlog that the team is like, yes, we really want to make this change, but you know, we don't have the time to do it. That's a great place to start and like show value with it. You know, this thing that goes to your backlog to die and never be touched. Those are great things to look at and experiment with as you're getting started with coding agents. And that's you know, what I used on my team too, is like, we already have this whole backlog full of changes we want to make. Why not start there and see like, all right, let's, you know, add a little more context to this and assign it to Copilot and just see what happens. And that was a really great way to get started and also make a lot of changes in our code base that we'd been wanting for a long time, but just didn't have the, you know, the capacity to ever deal with.
Hey folks, it's Robbie here. Does your team have too much on their plate right now? Between fixing bugs, shipping features, trying to get through that long overdue upgrade? Planet Argon, my company, might be able to help you. We offer team augmentation for companies that aren't ready to hire full-time employees, or maybe they just don't have the bandwidth to be recruiting right now, but still need to make and show some progress. We work with teams using Ruby on Rails, Laravel, Vue, Next.js, just to name a few technologies. And here's what we believe. Good software deserves a second act. So if your app is still doing its job, but it just needs some cleanup, some tender love and care, or a few extra hands, Planet Argon would love to help. Visit planetargon.com. That's planetargon.com. All right, let's get back to the show. Do you think it helps for teams to not just ask everybody on the team to start experimenting with it at the same time versus like, all right, we're going to have the team talks about it. We pick that one item together and then like, all right, you're going to go spend a day or two experimenting and come back and share what you learned. And then maybe we can over time get more comfortable at this. I'm seeing you nod your head there for our audience there, but do you think that might be appropriate or do you feel like free for all and we'll figure it out?
kind of depends. So the way that my team adopted it is it was released to us and we all just, it was free for all, figured out, and it was chaos in the beginning with like the number of opened pull requests and, you know, I feel like it gets a little bit easier because, you know, there's only so many pull requests, especially in that beginning batch that ended up like, you know, iterating to the point of getting merged. Yeah. Because we all had to sort of experiment with like, wow, okay, I don't want to review 100 files at a time. But yeah, it really depends on how the team works and what your code review process is too. Like if you have a process where you require, you know, 3 sign-offs, having everybody create, you know, 3 extra PRs each is probably going to be a little bit more difficult than if you work somewhere that you only need 1 sign-off from 1 other person. Yeah, so.
Are you using AI to review the PRs?
Yeah, we have a code review agent, which is on all of our pull requests at GitHub. It'll review.
Is that doing more than linting type of thing? Or
I would say that it goes a step up beyond linting for sure. But it's still not, I think, at the point where like we would only require code review agent. It does a really good first pass and does a really good job finding some bugs that I've like missed too, where I'm like, oh, wow, like I didn't think of that actually as a potential problem. Like, great job. And I've noticed that it's gotten a lot better over time too. As the LLM tools improve and as, you know, the tooling improves from the team that's building it, like it's definitely started out as like linting and now it's, you know, catching a lot of other things too. But I don't know that if we're ever going to get to a point where we're like, let's ship code that no human has looked at. Maybe, but I hope not again.
Especially, yeah. And again, it goes back to the, if some people might be listening and might be thinking, all right, so if we got an LLM generating the code and then we got LLM reviewing the code, who's responsible for the outcomes? It's whoever's merging it. But what if the LLMs are merging it? Okay.
What if they're merging it? And then they're just, then yeah, maybe the robots will build everything one day. And maybe. But I think having been pretty close to it for the past year, I think the more I learn about these tools, the more I'm like, I don't think we're going to get to that point ever. But yeah.
Having attended the last 2 GitHub universes, I think it was interesting just as an observer, an attendee, just to see how much the narrative changed in that year. And I feel like it's gotten a little bit more practical. So I'm less intimidated and less, it doesn't feel as nerve wracking to me. And just for our listeners, since I did mention it, so I did that little experiment with OpenAI Shell and I literally had it. I asked it, I was like, I needed to change a couple of links and add a small little piece of functionality to OpenAI Shell. And so I use Copilot to do that because GitHub gives me a free account with OpenAI Shell. And I did that, had a human review it. One of the other maintainers got merged. And one of our, and just sharing this, something that happened like in the last few days, but one of our Discord moderators decided to quit the project as a result of that. And so it gets into, because they do not want to be part of any AI slap project. And this is sets like an interesting scenario where I'm just like, I haven't, this episode will get published in the future. So I'm not worried about talking about this right now because I'm in the middle of it right now. But it's been interesting having a conversation with my other core team members. We're like, well, it was just a small little change. And I don't want to say I'm never going to use this, but I also like understand there's a responsibility for whatever we're shipping and pushing out. I'm like, this seemed like a really good use case for it. Where I'm like, it literally changed a couple of URLs in the code base and added like a little thing to open up a browser if you want to go look for some t-shirts. That's what it's for. I'm trying to sell t-shirts and stickers. So if you're using OMZ Shell, you can now type OMZ shop and it'll open up our web shop. Anyways, super, super intimidating stuff there. But now it's just like, oh, now we have to have this conversation as a team about how and when we're going to use AI, what's our policy. And some people are not going to be happy with that. And I think a lot of our listeners might be in that camp still. And maybe they will stay there and that's okay too. And I'm like, but it's an interesting time in the same way that I didn't want to have a lot of AI topics on this podcast 2 years ago. Cause I'm like, I don't know what to make of this yet. So having said that, I just wanted to add a little bit of clarification for that. So Brittany, thank you for listening to me talk and ramble on about that. Any advice on how to navigate that?
I have noticed this a lot recently too, actually. I feel like there's been more pushback. I'm on Blue Sky a lot. And just recently, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, there are still a lot of folks that are very anti-AI. And I would say that I started out also like when LLMs were first introduced and, you know, with all the things with the art being stolen to train them. Like,
but it's so fun. That,
yeah. there's definitely some moral issues around it. But I feel a little bit less bad about it when it comes to developer tooling, because a lot of it was trained on open source, and like open source was really made to be used by anybody for everything. And it also is like, I think developer tooling is also one of the good use cases for LLMs. It's not a thing that you really have to shove, you know, really stretch it to be like, oh yeah, this is for sure a thing that we need AI in. Like, it does really good. It does a really good job. So I think it's worth giving it a shot. Regardless of your opinion on it, I can pretty much guarantee it'll make you a better developer if you use it in a way that is not, you know, just vibe coding and hitting tab. If you use it to help yourself learn, it's a really great tool.
I think that's a fair perspective. And I know that your views do not necessarily represent the views of your employer.
So yes, thank you.
A little context there or make that little disclaimer for everybody there. So a couple of things I want to quickly touch on before we kind of wrap up. Can you tell us a little bit about your newsletter? I'll make sure people sign up for that.
Oh, yes. So I have a newsletter. It's called the Balanced Engineer Newsletter at balancedengineer.com. And I send it out monthly, and it's really just a group of the most interesting things I've come across in the last month or so. And I try to come up with topics that are balanced across the scope of engineering. So things that are like technical, things on leadership, things on, you know, work-life balance and, you know, mental health care and things like that. In part, it was really an effort to make myself more balanced and to make myself go, you know, try to read all of these resources and watch these videos across this broad scope of engineering. And it turned into something that I, you know, it's been really fun to send out to people and share with people.
That's awesome. I'll definitely include links to that in the show notes for people. And you're also a co-host of a podcast, right? And that is Overcommitted, correct? What's that podcast about?
That is a group of software engineers like myself who are just very passionate about software engineering. And we have talked about topics, everything from AI and the ethics of it to, you know, the ethics around social media and like what role developers have in that, to, you know, highlighting really cool open source projects like AppProto. So it's a mixture of the engineers that I met at GitHub, and folks that we interview.
And as a curiosity, as someone who hosts two podcasts now, what's it like having co-hosts? Is that a superpower that I have yet to realize, or is a lot of extra collaborative work that you don't have to like out that situation, I suppose, there? But
yeah, I think it was a little bit awkward at first when we were doing interviews and there would be like three people interviewing one person, but we have a process now where, you know, one person focuses on one topic, one person focuses on another. And I think it's also a very nice way of spreading like the work of having a podcast out. So like one of us does some of the marketing stuff and one of us does some of the editing stuff or whatever. That part's kind of nice.
Awesome. So that's overcommitted.dev, correct? Include links to that in the show notes as well for our listeners. And is there a book outside of our industry that you find yourself recommending to people?
This is a very cliche answer probably now. But one of my favorite books that I feel like has been like the most influential to me has been Atomic Habits. I think that is one that I will reread at least once a year. And even though it's, you know, one of the most popular books out there, it's also one that I feel like has brought a lot to my life as somebody who does too many things at once, typically.
Is there one atomic habit that you feel like you've implemented that has paid a lot of dividends for yourself personally or professionally?
I am hydrated now, finally, because of Atomic Habits. I'm like actually drinking enough water day to day. And that is a thing that like I always struggled with. And I feel like, you know, that's a thing that I'm doing a lot more of.
What was the habit that you implemented? Filling the water bottle up before something or?
Yeah, I have a little timer on my computer, which I actually just ignored while we were in this we're in this discussion, but every 45 minutes it'll pop up and say like, get some water. That's my indication to drink some water.
Drinking water. That sounds like a good one. For me, it was several years ago. I read it in the early summer of 2020 during the pandemic. And the simple thing of like putting out my running clothes before I went to bed made the hugest difference. And I think that was literally an example in the book, like put your workout clothes. You don't have to make a decision in the morning. And I'm like, changed my life. And I've tried to do that to some extent that I'm always curious about like the end of day routines, like especially as a coder or a business owner, or like, okay, what am I going to work on tomorrow? Getting some things in order and like, what do those habits look like? And some of that kind of stems from the Atomic Habits as well. So I'll include links for that. If anyone hasn't read that book yet, highly recommend it for me as well. And aside from your podcast and your newsletter, what else can people and listeners connect with you online?
I'm on Blue Sky and LinkedIn, and then everything's pretty much linked from my website, brittanyellick.com.
Excellent. Again, in the show notes for everybody. Brittany, thank you so much for joining me on Maintainable. Thank you so much for stopping by to talk shop with us. It's been a blast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Maintainable, a Planet Argon production. Editing by Claudia Armbruster. Post-production by Auden Morgan and Ella Svensson. Emotional support from the letter M. For Maintainable, for momentum, for making things better. If this episode resonated with you, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Keep showing up. See you next time. Maintainable.